From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we're going to take a close look at drowning. What are the statistics here in Utah, and how can this tragedy be prevented? And what exactly does drowning look like?
So I think it's important for people to remember that drowning happens really quickly and it's really quiet. It's not going to be this violent splashing, someone screaming for help, waving their arms, making a lot of noise like you might see on TV or in Hollywood movies. That's not what happens. It's really quiet.
That, plus your top local headlines and a review of Interim Day at the state legislature with Alliance for a Better Utah's Marianne Martindale, just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. Thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. A little bit later on the show, we're going to have a conversation about drowning with the Utah Department of Health's Jenny Johnson. First up, though, we have these headlines. Utah officials are spending about $550,000 on a detailed study of what would happen if the state took control of millions of acres of public lands currently under federal control. Legislators on Wednesday received the costs and an outline of the study, which is being conducted by three Utah universities and is scheduled to be released in November. The study looks at current and possible revenues on public lands and what agencies and activities would be affected if the state took control, among other items. The analysis was requested last year after legislators approved a law in 2012 that demands the federal government transfer much of Utah's public lands to the state by next year. Governor Gary Herbert and legislators argue that local officials would be better managers of the land. A federal indictment unsealed in Salt Lake City accuses eight suspects of money laundering and conspiring to distribute oxycodone in Utah and Nevada. They are the latest of 31 people indicted in connection with a lengthy investigation into distribution of the narcotic. The indictment unsealed Monday identifies the ringleader as Aaron Pala, a 31-year-old man who has lived in Utah and Nevada and currently is serving a prison sentence for a federal firearms conviction. He's charged with engaging in a continuing criminal enterprise. Others indicted were Mark Jaffe and Carolyn Barrera of Salt Lake City, Jason Jr. and Cindy Jr. of Pleasant Grove, Jonas Newell of Provo, and Candy Newman and Kevin Lynch, both of Las Vegas. Salt Lake City Police assisted the DEA and the IRS in that probe. Today was the first interim day at the Utah State Legislature. To get the details, we're joined now by Marianne Martindale, Executive Director of the nonprofit Good Government Group Alliance for Better Utah. Marianne, thanks for coming in today.
Always great to be here.
So there were a variety of committees meeting today, but let's actually talk about what today is. What is an interim day, and how many of them are there going to be?
Interim day is like the working group. So this is the opportunity for legislators to actually sort of work with all the other legislators, talk about their bills, get some studies done, and so forth, work out all the kinks on the bill. The idea is that they get the bill smoothed out, they get it where it's amenable to the broad majority, they get it approved in one of these interim committees, and then next session, when they present the bill, it comes with that somewhat, you know, seal of approval from interim, and it should theoretically make for a little bit more smooth sailing with getting a bill passed.
And today was the first of how many?
Six.
Okay.
The legislative session ended in March. They skip April. They go May, June, July. They skip August, September, October, November, and then they wait until the legislature starts again in January.
Okay, and so there were, as I said, a variety of committees meeting, and during that there was a reminder today about the Open and Public Meetings Act. What was that reminder?
Yeah, so that's mandated by law that every year on the first interim day they have a training, and this is basically a training to remind all of the committee chairs and all of the people participating in the committees what the legal requirements are about the Open and Public Meetings Act. So in other words, if I come and I present at a committee and I bring a slideshow or I bring like a PowerPoint, I have to provide that to the committee because they have to attach it to the minutes. So it's making sure that the public has access to everything that happens during these committees. We know that they're available on audio. You can listen live or you can listen later, but also any materials, anything that's handed out, anything that's presented, that also has to be included. It all has to be public record.
Do they have to disclose meetings with lobbyists or anything like that?
Well, that's probably a whole other subject.
Yeah, I bet. Also, in these committees, there were planning reports that were given. Who gives these reports? And maybe you could highlight a couple of them for us.
Sure. So again, this is a legislatively mandated requirement. In In other words, the legislature gives certain groups money and they write bills that mandate that these groups do certain activities. So this is where those groups come and report on the progress. Groups such as the Utah Transit Authority, state courts, Criminal Justice Commission, State Board of Education, and so on. So they all have to present to their respective committees. So if it was the State Board of Education, they obviously would be representing to the Education Interim Committee. But some of the more interesting ones today were there was a report on the transfer of federal lands where they discussed, you know, where they were in that process in terms of trying to work with the federal government to get the land that the state is claiming that they should be able to reclaim, as it were, back from the federal government. And they talk about the money that's been spent so far doing that. There was a report by the UTA, a very preliminary report, on their plans to increase bus and transit use. This was something that had a lot of attention during the last legislative session. UTA has spent a lot of money on trains and, you know, front runner and tracks, but the bus system is still very lacking and something that a lot of low-income advocates have been pushing for better bus system. And so this was, again, a very preliminary report, which happens a lot, especially the first interim session, but about how they're going to try to address those needs. And then campaign finance timing. So we had a big change in the legislature this last session. They narrowed the time that you have to report campaign donations. If you are in a primary battle or a convention battle, you have to, I believe it's 48 hours of when you receive a donation. That's much shorter than what it's ever been. Mm-hmm. So they explained all of that so that, you know, this is new to legislators. A lot of them haven't, you know, they haven't had to do this yet. So this is their first time in there.
And they have to understand the rules and what they have to actually comply with in this new rule. Okay, finally today, Marianne, something called the master study list that gets some play during interim day. What is the master study list?
The master study list is what everybody who doesn't get a bill passed during the session wants to be on. So this is a list that both houses have decided these are things we will work on during the interim session. It doesn't preclude other things from coming up because they can still present, but they have to go through the committee chair. They have to try to get those things on. If it's on the master study list, it will be discussed. So you may have a bill last session that didn't get passed, but it didn't get defeated. It may have been sent back with a recommendation that it be put on the master study list for interim work. So that's actually a good thing. It may be something that they say, oh, you know, we feel as a legislature that this is something that's worth pursuing, but we don't know enough information yet. We need more information. Instead of just killing the bill and making that legislator then start from scratch, it gives them an opportunity to do it through this working group, which is essentially, you know, as I said, what interim session is.
In some ways, it could be on occasion bills waiting from the last session to reemerge.
Right, exactly. Okay. A lot of them will be that, in fact.
Marianne, maybe to close things out, we could get a little bit of trivia from the Capitol, something we'll do during each interim day of the legislative session. What's today's trivia point?
Today's trivia is lions. So you may not be aware, but at the east entrance and the west entrance of the Capitol building, each side has two sculpted lions. They were originally sculpted out of plaster. They have been since sculpted out of marble to withstand the elements, as it were. They have names. One of them is Fortitude, one is Integrity, the other is Honor, and the fourth one is Patience.
Well, we can hope that our legislators are paying attention to those names.
Exactly.
Marianne Martindale is the executive director of the nonprofit Good Government Group Alliance for Better Utah. Thanks again for this update.
Thank you.
And you are tuned into The Rundown here on KCPW. We'll be back in just a moment. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the show, we're going to examine the statistics surrounding drowning in the state of Utah and some common steps you can take while the weather warms up to try and prevent this tragedy. We're joined on the phone now for this conversation by Jenny Johnson with the Violence and Injury Prevention Program of the Utah Department of Health. Jenny, thanks very much for taking the time today.
You're welcome.
So let's get a sense first of how many people drown both here in Utah and in the United States. Do we have numbers on that?
Yeah, so nationally, drowning ranks about fifth among the leading causes of unintentional injury deaths in the United States. That equates to about 10 people dying from unintentional drownings every day, and of these drownings, two are going to be kids younger than 14. Mm. In Utah, drowning is still a leading cause of death for children under the age of 14. We see with kids in particular, about 11 children between the ages of 0 and 19 drown each year in our state. But in Utah, our drowning deaths often go up during years where there's really heavy wet spring and there's heavy winter runoff. And so it kind of, we'll see numbers kind of fluctuate up and down just depending on how our snowpack is and how quickly it's melting in the springtime. Hmm. And that impacts some of the drowning patterns that we see in Utah that I can talk about a little bit later. But most of these kids, like I said, there's about 11 kids each year that will drown. Just to give you that example to explain a little bit more about why we see an increase in years where there's heavy runoff. Mm-hmm. In 2011, this was a really wet spring that we had, and there was a super high, very cold winter runoff from all the snow that we'd received. And there was actually 38 drowning deaths that year, and half were kids under 19. But then in 2012, 2013, and pretty early into the drowning season this year, those deaths were much, much lower just because we didn't have as heavy snowpack, and so our spring runoff wasn't as nearly the problem that we saw in 2011.
And so essentially this is when you see, like, you know, I guess higher rivers, higher water levels, and kids getting caught up in that as a result of the runoff.
Yeah, so it makes sense once you hear some of the patterns that we see with drowning in our state just because of the weather that we have and the seasons and the landscape. But you have to remember, like, other states like Florida, drowning is the number one cause of death. I mean, it's much more serious because people have pools and oceans and rivers and streams, and they have summertime and nice weather all year.
Right.
But in Utah, those patterns are different in our state. And so May through September-ish is often, we kind of call it our drowning season in Utah, because that's when we start to see more of these deaths occur or near drownings happening. And we see three very distinct patterns of childhood drownings in our state. And the first pattern that we see, unfortunately, way too much, is with young toddlers between the ages of 1 and 4 who wander off. Often the most common scenario that we see in these deaths is there's an under-supervised child who is often at a big family gathering or a family party, a family reunion, and they're somewhere near an open body of water like a reservoir or a stream or a river or something like that. And the child just wanders off, and no one really sees them wander off, and they fall in and they get into trouble really, really quickly. You know, sometimes in these large family gatherings, they may be indoors, but again, there's an open body of water nearby, and there's often not an adult who is officially designated as what we kind of term the child watcher. Hmm. And these child watchers are supposed to only be focused on making sure all the little kids stay away from the water, they're playing by it safely. Because, again, with the high spring runoff, most of our drowning deaths in our state happen in open bodies of water.
Right.
So it just takes seconds for some kid to fall in and get carried away, and the water is going to be super, super cold, and tragedy can happen really, really, really quickly. You know, that scenario happens over and over and over again. And the other scenario that we see far too often is teenagers who are typically males. They're often with a group of friends or a couple buddies, and they're sitting at a lake or a reservoir. And these are going to be more of your witness drownings, like what happened earlier this week with the 19-year-old who drowned in Harriman Reservoir, where they overestimate their swimming abilities, they underestimate the temperature of the water, how far it is that they're swimming, they don't have a life jacket on. We see a lot of these teenagers actually drown fully clothed because they're just goofing off and playing in the water. And they, like I said, they just don't realize the inherent risk and danger behind that. And so toddlers and teen boys are the pattern after pattern, and it happens every single year. And then the other, a much smaller percentage, but we do see this every year as well, are young infants, typically under the age of 2. They're left alone in bathtubs, or they're left with a sibling who may be only 4 or 5 years of age. You know, they're still pretty young themselves, and parents get distracted and the baby slips under the water, and it just, again, it takes seconds, and it only takes up to an inch of water for a baby to drown like that, and it happens really fast. That is what we see happen in Utah, and that's just because of how Utahns recreate. So that's why it's so important, I think, for people to realize that, you know, these toddlers who wander off, and these teenagers, often teenage boys, they're your high-risk groups that parents have got to be aware that these are the people that it happens to.
Jenny, I don't know if you can answer this question, but I'm wondering about how, especially, I mean, you think about summer's coming up and people are out at the reservoir, they're at lakes, and I'm wondering how we can recognize people drowning. What are the signs that people exhibit when they are near to drowning or in distress?
Yeah, so I think it's important for people to remember that drowning happens really quickly and it's really quiet. It's not going to be this violent splashing, someone screaming for help, waving their arms, making a lot of noise like you might see on TV or in Hollywood movies.
Right.
That's not what happens. It's really quiet. And there are some signs of drowning. There was a great article by Dr. Pia who talks about the instinct drowning response and talks about what it's going to look like when someone is in trouble in the water and how quiet that is. And people can actually be witnessing someone drowning without even knowing that they're drowning, because drowning often doesn't look like drowning is kind of the phrase that's used.
Hmm.
So, if you're in an open body of water, oftentimes someone who's in trouble is going to be facing the shoreline where everybody is, or where their boat is, or, you know, their family or whatever. Their mouth and their head is going to be right at the water level. It's going to be looking like they're probably treading water in terms of where their head is. Their heads may be tilted back because they're trying to exhale and inhale as quickly as they can before they bob back down under the water. So their head's going to be back. It's going to be right at the surface level of the water. If you're close enough to see their face, their eyes could be closed, or they could be kind of glossed over, or they could be completely panicked in their eyes. But again, they're not going to be screaming for help and splashing around, because their body actually physiologically goes into fight or flight mode and is only going to be thinking about, you have to breathe oxygen. So everything else it's not important right now. Yelling is not important. We have to breathe.
Right.
So,
in fact, so they're kind of incapable of doing anything other than that.
Yeah.
Okay.
They really are. I mean, and some people, they may look like they're trying to climb a ladder, like their arm movements, they're vertical in the water. They're not going to be face down yet. They're vertical in the water, but they're not really swimming. It might look like they're trying to move. They're not going anywhere. They're not really kicking. Their arms may be kind of coming up and down. They actually lose control of what their arms are doing when they're suffocating in the water like that, because, again, their brain is saying, we need to breathe. And so all they're trying to do is get their mouth and nose up out of the water, which is why their head would be right at the water level, and they're going to be tilted back like that. And so another thing that is key to watch for is, so if somebody's not in trouble and they're playing in the water and they get their hair in their face, they're going to brush the hair out of their eyes so they can see. Someone who's drowning will have their hair hanging down in their face, and they're not going to be moving it out of their way.
Right.
Because that's, again, that's not important. You're trying to breathe. And so you can watch for that as well. And
that's,
you know, not to say that someone who isn't in the water and yelling, help me, doesn't need help. Again, drowning is going to be silent. And if you're close enough to yell at them, you should yell at them, are you all right? And if they can't answer that, you may only have seconds before they go down and don't come back up. If they can answer you, yes, I'm okay, then they're probably all right. But if they can't talk to you, you know that they're in big trouble.
Right. And I think it's interesting. I mean, I think that it's important, the point that you made before, which is that obviously, if a person is in distress in other ways, they may be getting to the point of exhaustion. And if they still can yell and are yelling for help, then obviously they need that help. But when people are actually drowning, they are unable to do that. And so you need to be the person who makes contact. So that's kind of the first step in what a person should do, is try and assess the situation and find out what's going on with this person who may or may not be in distress. But what else should someone do at this point in terms of if they see somebody who's in distress?
I mean, obviously, if you see someone that's in distress and you can call 911 or for help, you should do that. Or if you're at a pool or something and there's a lifeguard, you know, you need to get help or send someone to get help immediately. Because even if you're able to pull somebody out who's experiencing a near drowning, they may need CPR or something like that. And so you need to get help as quick as you can. One thing, you know, people always think, well, throw them a life vest or throw them something to, you know, pool ring or whatever. Well, if they're really drowning, they are not going to be able to think and to control their body movements to be able to grab that item that you're throwing at them.
Right.
If they can talk to you and they're saying, I need help, by all means, throw them something. Get a big stick or a pool stick and hold it out to them and pull them in, you know.
Right.
But if they can't talk to you, you know, where our drownings happen in open bodies of water with unpredictable currents, unpredictable water temperatures, you know, as a rescuer, you do have to be very careful about jumping in and getting trouble yourself. If the water is freezing cold, you aren't going to be able to last for very long either, and now you have two people in trouble.
Hmm.
So we've seen drownings before where a parent will jump in to save their child, and they both end up getting in trouble, or the parent ends up drowning after they've saved the child because it's freezing in the water,
right,
and they're exhausted. And so
maybe hypothermia sets
in. You know, really, you have to look at it not in terms of what am I going to do to rescue somebody, but what do I need to do to prevent this from happening to my family and my friends in the first place?
Hmm.
I would jump in after my child too, knowing that I might be in trouble myself. At that point, it's too late to prevent it. And you know, that's why we want people to be educated on how drownings actually happen in our state, and then you can take precautions to prevent a drowning from actually happening.
Right. Well, it's such a tragedy.
It doesn't really answer your question. I mean, I don't have a good...
Right, no,
I'm not a rescue swimmer, you know. Most people overestimate how well they can swim, especially in cold water in Utah.
I wanted to ask, I mean, this may be out of your purview as well. When somebody is rescued or pulled out of the water and they're unconscious, if they've stopped breathing, I mean, the obvious thing to do is to start CPR, but, you know, you have to know what you're doing, correct?
Yes. However, there are laws in Utah that protect people who, you know, are not a nurse or a physician or an EMT or something, that they do CPR on somebody as a bystander. They're protected under law. And so, you know, you need to start chest compressions and get their heart pumping. And hopefully by then you've been able to call for help, for professional help, and somebody's on their way. But don't hesitate if they're not breathing to start CPR. I mean, most people have some idea of how to do chest compressions, or they've seen it. And if you are going to be out in the water a lot, if you have a boat or you have a pool, you should be trained in CPR. I mean, parents should be trained in CPR. You never know when you're going to need it on a loved one or a complete stranger.
All right.
So we would just really encourage people to learn infant and adult CPR. And yeah, if someone gets in trouble, to use that on them. One little tip that I did find, like, you know, if you do find yourself in a drowning situation and you're starting to, you know, that you're in trouble and exhibiting some of those signs of drowning that we talked about earlier, if you can, you need to stop and try to float. Now, if you can float either on your back, or there's a rescue kind of float that they often teach people in swimming courses, swimming lessons, if you can do that and calm yourself down, that can help too. But it kind of depends on the situation and how exhausted somebody is, if they can actually relax enough to try to do that.
Right, and requires the recognition on your part, and, you know, hopefully we're all that self-aware. You know, you mentioned some of the things we can do to try and prevent this. You talked about assigning an adult to be the person who supervises the children at gatherings. What are some other prevention strategies when it comes to preventing drowning?
Well, the first thing is for children especially, I mean, this sounds impossible to do, but it's so important, is to never leave a child alone near water. Somebody needs to be with them, and not 30 feet away from them. You need to be an arm's length from your kid when they're near water, because it can happen so very quickly.
Right.
So that's the number one thing, is you don't leave them alone in the tub. You don't answer the phone, or someone knocks at the door, you ignore it, or you pull them out of the tub, you take them with you. You don't leave them alone. The one thing with, you know, having an adult watch the kids is they need to realize they need to be actively watching these kids around the water. That means you're not talking on your phone, you're not texting, you're not talking to your, you know, a friend over here and kind of glancing back and forth and watching what's happening. That's not active supervision. If you need to take breaks, you know, being at a family gathering is not really the funnest thing if you're assigned to watch all the kids with the water and you don't get to enjoy everything. You know, take breaks and switch off and take turns, but it has to be active. You got to be close enough to grab them if they got into trouble right away. The other thing, especially if you're out boating, life jackets are going to save your life.
Right.
And so everyone needs to have a life jacket when they're on the boat or playing in the water. It doesn't matter if you're a good swimmer or not. There are excellent swimmers who drown. So, you know, like we've talked about with water temperature and currents and people just overestimating distance between places when they're in the water and they get tired, you know, you need a life jacket on.
Right. Jenny Johnson is the Injury Prevention Coordinator with the Violence and Injury Prevention Program of the Utah Department of Health. Jenny Johnson, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
Along with this interview, we'll include some links and resources about getting CPR certified, recognizing the signs of drowning, and ways to prevent it at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and this is The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks once more for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, tune in for a look at the use of drones in the great outdoors. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.